This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you. My slides. First of all, thank you, Kathy, for those words. And I'm glad you ended on the positive note, because we are living in a doom and gloom world right now. And I think we have to draw on what is positive and think about where we take that in the future. I'd like to thank the Royal College of Midwives for inviting me. I'm also the president of the American College of Nurse Midwives. And so it's a great honor to come and present to you, who to us represent something that we envy, where midwifery is the standard of care in the country. We attend about 10% of births in the United States, and that has grown consistently, but it's not where we want to be. So thank you for having me. This talk is going to be a little bit about research and theory, about what it is that we do to optimize birth, what it is that we do in caring for women. I'm going to share a little bit with you about a comparison between the UK and the US. I was fortunate to spend the 2008 here as a Fulbright scholar, studying your efforts to care for women, and then talk a little bit about forward thinking, particularly in our political arenas, as we work with our politicians and with women to provide the best services possible. I just would like to acknowledge the many people who have helped me, and particularly those last four people who are my colleagues and friends at King's College London. So what does it mean to optimize birth? I would say to you that our worldview of this mother and baby will frame how we ask the questions and how we measure the outcomes of what it means to optimize birth. As Kathy said, we are working in a risk-averse world, which some call the 1% doctrine, where we pour everything in to prevent the 1% of risk. So if our look at this woman and her baby is only as a potential for risk, it will change how we care for her, how we ask the research questions, versus if we think about her innate capacity to grow a baby, to birth a baby, and to mother a baby. Very different worldviews of how we approach it. And those worldviews come within the context in which we live, in which we are educated, in which we learn to grow up as mothers and as fathers and as clinicians. Our ability to midwife is going to be affected by that context in which we are working. When you are removed from the bedside and are focusing more and more on technology, it will change your ability to work. When you do not have enough staff, as Kathy mentioned, as one of the primary problems, it will influence our ability to practice. There was a study done in the United States by Ellen Annandale, who's now up in Scotland, who looked at a birth center. And she talks about the midwife's ability to deal with institutional conflict as being a way to manage the stress that goes in with being able to practice the way you want versus dealing with the institutional stressors that might prevent that. So I want you to keep that concept in mind as I continue on in this talk. I don't think I have to remind anybody in this room that birth is a life-altering event. Women remember it forever, and it will influence their long-term well-being. Women who feel most satisfied with their birth are going to have higher self-esteem, higher self-confidence, and it changes the way they feel about themselves and about other women. Women who are betrayed by that experience, who are traumatized, will sometimes go on to develop PTSD, somewhere around 6%. We want to prevent that. So how do we do that? Part of it is looking at what is it that we do at birth? How do we intervene or not intervene that makes a difference in optimizing outcomes? The World Health Organization states that we should only use interventions that are established in best evidence. One of the ways to look at that is looking at optimality. So the term optimal, optimality, optimizing, obviously are all related. In my dissertation research 12 years ago, we asked expert midwives in the United States what the most important outcome was. It wasn't avoiding a cesarean. It was that the mother and the baby emerged as healthy as they possibly could in the given situation. When we looked at this term across many disciplines, we defined it from a perinatal perspective as that you get the best outcome possible using the least interventions, but within the context of the woman's social, medical, and obstetric history, which means you are individualizing your care. You're not using every intervention for every woman. Now, when to optimize birth and optimize labor, what we need to do is to support women's innate capacity, innate physiologic capacity to birth. Labor is very related to a very complex neurohormonal endocrine system. And I think all of us have experienced that when a woman comes into hospital, her labor stalls, or it can. And until she feels safe, it may not start up again on its own. But too often, we don't give her that environment, give her that space for her body to rewrite itself and get the hormonal pathways working well again. We just go straight to intervening on whatever is medication we decide we're going to use, or to rupture membranes, or whatever. We don't intervene in the process in a low-tech way. And so what happens is the emotional state and response to pain and fear, both on the mother's side and on the clinician's side, can get in the way. If we support physiologic birth, all of those pathways work well. They help create the path for endorphins to help women deal with pain, to help her expel the infant. An undisturbed infant will crawl to the mother's breast, and those continuous endogenous hormones will promote breastfeeding. So in other words, what's good for the mother is also good for the baby. Now, we have very good evidence to show that of those things that we should do that promote physiologic optimal birth, we're not. We're underusing many of these aspects of care. I want you to think about your own practice and where you're working and thinking, do we use these to the best level that we can? And we're overusing these. And I would say the United States is probably the champion in this, where 80 to 90% of women will have an epidural in most of our institutions. And we have a cesarean rate, a national rate of 32%, and much higher in many institutions. What is really disturbing is that many women have an incomplete understanding of the potential complications of childbirth. They simply are unaware that there are problems with some of the interventions that we do. Many feel overwhelmed, frightened, and weak in the process, not a way to go about becoming a mother. So it's very clear we're not doing our best, particularly in the United States, and that those trends are becoming global. So what are the facilitators and what are the barriers to optimizing birth in women in this climate of decreasing resources financially? I would say that one of the greatest barriers is the implosion of technology. We live in a world, particularly in my country, where technology is revered almost more than anything. This is a quote from a New England Journal of Medicine of looking at continuous electronic fetal monitoring. About 94% of women in the United States will have continuous monitoring, despite the evidence that that is not related to optimal outcomes. The tension about that in our institutions is primary. It's extremely hard to change practice. I think as any of you have tried to do that, it's very, very hard to get the women off the monitor. And this is actually a quote from New Zealand of a midwife talking about going into the hospital, shutting the door, and keeping everybody else out. Well, that sets up a lot of tension by the people who are on the other side of the door. And in my own research, I've heard this over and over again, and people aren't talking and working together to change. Women also have a fair amount to do. They've been forces in changing childbirth practices over the past century. But today's woman may not have the same beliefs that we particularly do about childbirth. We did a discourse analysis of the top 10 selling childbirth books in the United States, ranked on Amazon.com. You'll be glad to know that there are some very interesting books out there. Of the top 10, two were written by former Playboy Playmates, experts in normal childbirth, I would say. You'll be glad to know that this has a companion called Pregnancy Sucks for Fathers. It's not a pretty picture. The language in 70% of the books predisposes risk. What can go wrong? And the damage it will do to your body, particularly your vagina. If you were unsophisticated, you would come out of that read saying, I should have a cesarean, and God knows I shouldn't have any pain, and I should have the baby on the day that I want to have it. We have to know what women are reading, and we have to be involved in changing this. Now, I'm speaking for the United States. This was the top sellers in the United States. Very few of the books presented birth as salutogenic, as Sudan has so artfully described, or a birth that creates health in the process. We have to change that. There's a term called the nocebo effect. It's Latin for I will harm. It's an ill effect caused by the suggestion that something is harmful. So we have to start changing those suggestions. In other words, we are the instruments. And we are the instruments of change. So when you think about this, think about the use of presence as one way to change. This is a quote from a chapter that I had the great honor of writing with Nikki Leap and Tricia Anderson before she died. And this comment by this woman was that the power of presence that has no decipherable language, and yet I felt trust immediately. It gave me the self-belief that I could do it. I could give birth knowing whatever the outcome, I would find my way. So when you look at these pictures, I want you to just absorb what that presence feels like. The connection between a midwife and the woman, those in the room with her, and the quietness but background observation and careful assessment. So I'm going to fast forward to 2008. From around 2001 and to 2007, I spent a lot of time over here doing presentations at the Normal Birth Conference, and then was invited to apply for a Fulbright Fellowship, which I was very fortunate to get, which is meant to exchange colleagues and researchers and educators between countries, and then for the U.S. citizen to come back to the United States and bring those messages. And I was very interested in understanding how the NHS toolkit to support normal birth and decrease cesarean rates was being implemented. So we did a study with King's College London, and my colleague Jane Sandel is the co-investigator, to look at two trusts that had been identified to us as being very committed to normalizing birth and optimizing birth. And what we found that those two trusts, with together over 12,000 births a year, had a wide range of complexity, with cesarean rates as low as 12% in one midwifery-led team to as high as 69% in one private service. That private service, I was told off the cuff in a hallway by an obstetrician, said, well, that's where the neurotic Americans have their babies. I never got to talk to them. This is what we found overall, and you should be very proud in terms of your efforts to optimize birth in this country. You are, to me, a model for what you do. You trust women, you trust birth, you use evidence, you have teamwork of obstetricians, midwives, and others working together, and you have an integrated system of care compared to the United States, where we have a healthcare industry. You listened to the woman's story. If you saw this guideline in the United States, it would say, take her history. It's a very different language than listening to her story. You try to keep birth normal. Your consultant midwives talk about advertising for midwives who wish to support women in normal birth, who are passionate about it. And when a woman does become ill or is not completely normal, you try to salvage what is normal in that labor and birth. It's a process. And in my year of study, of many, many hours of observation, I saw this played out in many different examples, which we're still writing about. It's not across the board in every setting, but certainly really sterling examples. One of your guidelines talks about midwives should be aware of the research that shows that women are sensitive to the approach of their carers and will try to do what is expected of them. This is talking particularly about keeping women out of bed and is an example of what I'm talking about, that we are the instruments of care. What we do is a type of intervention. So in keeping women out of bed, what we saw were beds placed high up so women couldn't get into them. And lots of things around to help her stay out of bed, to help her use things, and to send the message that she can do it. You use pools, you use Entonox. In the United States, we have two hospitals and in the entire country that use Entonox. Not available to us. And we're trying desperately to get it reintroduced from many decades ago, and we have no equipment for it. It's all gone out of service, and to reintroduce it means we have to go through our FDA, our Federal Drug Administration. So it's a very high mountain we have to climb. And women talked about, the women that we interviewed talked about how the environment that was created for them was like a haven. You keep women off the monitor, and you ask the question why she was put on it in the first place. I like this picture because this picture shows a lot about environment. This is a very, very busy maternity unit. The monitor's in the hall, and there's nobody in that hall because the way they designed the unit was that it really meant the midwife needed to be in the room because there's no central monitoring. And when you go to our hospitals, it's just central monitoring. You see everyone out at the desk watching the monitor. I asked the question of all the obstetricians I talked with, how did you change this? And it was a long process and still not always easy. But as this obstetrician said, if you don't keep looking for things, you're not going to overreact. You nourish women with food. We can't. Very rare can we feed women in labor. And you have visible and vocal leaders, an open culture in which the staff are supported and challenged in their decision making. We heard over and over again the common dialogue among midwives, obstetricians, pediatricians as they discuss cases. Now, I was told that where the two trusts that we examined were not necessarily the same as all trusts, so I would want you to know that this study was limited in that, and you need to think about what rings true with your own unit and where you're working of what we saw in these units. The barriers to what we saw to optimizing normal birth were staffing patterns, just as Kathy mentioned. If you don't have enough staff, you can't provide that one-on-one presence that you need to have. We also saw inconsistency across teams, so not every team had that same commitment. Perceptions of safety and risk were probably the most fundamental area of discussion for negotiation, including guidelines and relationships among professionals, and presenting and informing women of risks. So the care was guided by an ethos of shared decision-making between the professional and the woman, but that process required an understanding and tolerance of risk and required skill. And where we saw this the greatest was in presenting VBAC and elective cesarean. And coping with uncertainty and clinicians, professionals dealing with the uncertainty. I'll give you one quick example of a woman who had had her fourth baby and came and wanted an elective cesarean. And she had been so traumatized by a midwife on her fourth baby who had not listened to her when she said she needed something for pain. And she said, I don't want to go through this again. And through very careful discussion, informed decision making, they created a birth plan, and she had her next birth, twins, vaginally, and it said that it was the most brilliant birth she'd had. So she healed in that process, but it was a very committed process to working through with her and dealing with that uncertainty. So we had many, many stories of that. Finally, I want to come back to the Maternity Matters document. This is incredibly important in how you work with stakeholders. This document was referred to in our interviews by midwives of how it set the foundation for making change. So I do hope that it doesn't go on hold and that it will be implemented. So, to come back to the theme of this conference of maternity services in a changing world, you're dealing with a change in the political arena, so are we. It's been a very rough month for us. So I'm sure you recognize the fellow on the left, it's Sarah Palin on the right, the spiritual head of the Tea Party. And we now are grappling with, okay, we've done healthcare reform, but now what does that mean as we try to implement it within this very complicated scenario? So you have to look at it with some humor and some creativity, and you have to learn to dance together, which is what we're doing in Congress right now. To look to the future, it's important that we examine personally our practice as our ability to be instruments of care, to understand how our public, our social media is presenting birth and our role in that, to look at our education and what we're teaching our midwives, our obstetricians, our pediatricians about birth and how we can influence that, and then to look at policy and where are we in that process. So I wish you well in this conference. I'm very excited to be here and look forward to a really stimulating 2 days. Thank you.